This is Attention Humans, the podcast of the University of Colorado Consortium for Climate Change and Health.
Each episode, we explore the human dimensions of climate change with some of the leading experts at the University of Colorado and beyond.
I'm Jake Fox.
I'm Cameron Nicewander. We're your hosts for the show.
It is our goal to help you, our listeners, learn about the health consequences of global warming.
And ask you to get involved in personal and political efforts to slow climate change.
As always, please check out our webpage, cuconsortium.org/podcast, for episode summaries, show notes, and our comment box.
Without further ado, on to the show.
And this long line of cars is all because of you.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to part 3 of 3 of our climate science primer with Dr. Chris Karnauskas, who is an atmospheric scientist up in Boulder and a member of the University of Colorado Consortium for Climate Change and Health. In this segment, we'll discuss with Dr. Karnauskas some of his work on small island nations, as well as some of his thoughts for how we can address climate change more broadly. If you haven't listened to our previous 2 climate science primer segments, we highly recommend that you do because they provide a nice scaffold, which we think is essential for getting the most out of this podcast. All right, without any further delay, let's tune back in with Dr. Karnauskas.
In addition to the science, Cam and I are doing this podcast because we want to highlight some of the health effects of climate change. I know some of your work on small island nations, you know, they're starting to feel the effects of this.
Right.
Can you, put a human face on this, bring it home?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of what drew me to do some research on small islands, I guess one part is that I'm trained oceanographer more than anything else, but so I'm always looking at the ocean. But you know, there are people out there, and I think they're living on the front lines of climate change. Think about all the unique vulnerabilities that people who live on small islands face. That you know, we here in the middle of a large continent, it's different for us. So they have fewer places to go. They have fewer resources and ways to collect fresh water, for example. This at the same time as potentially changing fresh water from rain, they also surely have problems from sea level rise. If they're anywhere near the tropics, they're concerned about increases in the intensity of hurricanes and things like that out in the tropical oceans. So a lot of my work has actually focused on just that, changes in tropical cyclones near some of these islands, and also potential changes in rainfall. And, so we look at that. And at the same time as, you know, you might have an island where the rain isn't predicted to change at all, but that doesn't mean they're out of the woods, because rain is just the input of water. Okay, so if you leave water on the ground for too long, you know that it evaporates. And the warmer it is, the more evaporation is going to happen. So that's kind of how I look at the water problem for small islands. Is I try to develop approaches that look at it from both sides, both the supply and the demand. And you know, the warming world means that pretty much just no matter where you are, you're going to be faced with some amount of freshwater stress for your population, because that evaporation is going to only increase as the temperatures go up.
We wanted to also speak a little bit about, last October, the International Panel on Climate Change came out with that special report detailing the difference kind of between 1.5 degrees Celsius of global warming versus 2. Mm-hmm. And we know a lot of that report was really driven by the concern that small island nations are having about their future. Can you talk a little bit about what the effects of that were?
Yeah, it's a squishy concept, I think, this 1.5 and 2. You know, let's just define what 1.5 means. That means the global average temperature is kept to 1.5 degrees Celsius. That doesn't mean anyone is guaranteed to only physically themselves experience only 1.5 degrees. So, you know, one really useful thing to remember, I think, is that the land is warming a lot faster than the ocean, about twice as fast. Okay, so with that, of course, 70-some percent of the Earth is covered by ocean. So just to keep in mind what 1.5 means is that means quite a bit warmer for people on land. To balance the ocean, that's going to be warming less than that for an overall 1.5. So these are pretty squishy concepts, not just because of that, but because there's really you know, it's a spectrum. There's no light switch that flips the second you get to 1.5 or 2. It's a very, it's a holistic look at a wide range of climate impacts. And 1.5 and 2 degrees came out as a clear enough delineation between the severity of impacts that that seems like a useful pair of targets to think about. But it doesn't mean that there won't be any dire impacts of climate change with 1.5. It doesn't necessarily scale linearly like that.
So basically, 1.5, there will still be deleterious bad effects for some people on the globe. But 2, there may be more effects or worse.
That's right. And, okay. You know, like I said, these are squishy concepts resulting from long negotiations with large groups of people in rooms. I mean, you know, there's nothing magical about those numbers. And if I'm honest, I'm not at all optimistic that we even have the ability to keep it at 1.5. We're almost there. We would have to make such drastic impacts that we would probably have to be seeing the political will for it coming out right now, including in the U.S. I think without the U.S., it's going to be really hard.
Kind of dovetailing off of that and maybe taking a step away from the hard science for a second, what kind of things can we do to address climate change more broadly?
Yeah, that's my favorite question because I have absolutely no idea. You know, when I think about addressing climate change, there's this spectrum of possibilities from individual actions, you know, riding your bike to work instead of driving, all the way out to international agreements actually being adopted and acted upon. And, you know, I can't help but look at the world and the society we live in and say, we're locked into our way of life to some extent. We're not locked into it, but we're really married to it for a while here. Especially in the U.S., we don't have cities laid out by like European cities are, where it would be a little bit easier to, get to work, have a lot of public transportation that's actually efficient. People have to get to work, and people have to consume energy in order to carry about their daily lives. It's a very challenging prospect that I'm really glad I'm on the scientific side of things, and I think the other side of it, what you're asking about right now, is much more challenging. I would like to see a lot more earnest efforts at the national level and the international level, but to actually address this, there's a lot of well-meaning people. I don't know that there's enough well-meaning people right now to, you know, have it truly be a bottoms-up kind of thing. I know that sounds very depressing, but I think we need some large changes from above to help us get moving in the right direction. And, you know.
Yeah, and one reason we're doing this podcast is to, when, you know, teach people about our climate crisis and some of the effects it's going to have, with the hopes of motivating them to action. So, what recommendations or what advice do you have for people who want to get involved? What can they do to make a difference?
We're past the point where everyone just remembering to turn off their light at home when they leave a room. We're beyond that point. You know, that level of you know, that's that good feeling stuff, that might have been enough if we really got moving 50 years ago, but we're very close to a point where a lot of climate change is already in the pipeline, and a whole lot more will be there if we don't do anything big really soon, like in the next 20 years.
We were hoping you could maybe help us with understanding any of the innovation out there right now that is going into trying to design large scale change in the future.
Oh, so you're probably talking about geoengineering.
Yes.
Yeah. So this is a very hot topic, has been for some time, and it's quite a contentious topic in the climate science community. You know, for example, I was just talking about, you know, in my opinion, we need large scale changes very quickly. And I can understand why you would ask about geoengineering options where we actually, you know, implement technology to save the day. Well, there are some of those technologies, but they don't necessarily fix the problem to begin with. So, for example, one geoengineering solution that's proposed and discussed quite a bit is called solar radiation management, or SRM. It's a class of different approaches, and you know, one of the easiest to envision is injecting a bunch of reflective particles into the stratosphere. So if you don't know your layers of the atmosphere, I'd forgive you for that. The second one up is the stratosphere. We're down here in the troposphere. That's where all our weather is. Up in the stratosphere where the airplanes fly. Okay, so there's a lot of talk about, well, what if we flew some big jets up there and injected a bunch of sulfate aerosols in there? So basically they reflect sunlight back to space instead of letting it come down to the Earth. You can see how that is kind of like a upside down greenhouse effect. It's kind of doing the opposite thing. Instead of trapping heat in, it's preventing the solar radiation from getting in the first place. So that sounds nice, because what that would do is we can just keep on emitting our carbon dioxide like we are today, no problem. We're just going to turn the sun down a little bit so that it doesn't warm up. And you can imagine that's going to probably keep temperature down to some extent, but that's not going to fix that's not going to solve the problem of having CO2 in the atmosphere in the first place. And there's a lot of impacts of CO2 that are very negative impacts on people and on ecosystems from CO2, and this is obviously not going to fix the problem. If anything, it will make us feel emboldened to emit more CO2 if we feel like we can just keep the temperature at bay anyways. So think about the ocean. A lot of the carbon dioxide, about a third of it that we're emitting, is actually going into the ocean. And that's causing big problems for marine ecosystems. Those shell-building organisms that are the very base of the marine food web, they have a hard time building their shells and just existing when there's too much carbon dioxide in the ocean. And that's the broader term for that issue, which a lot of folks have heard of, is ocean acidification. So ocean acidification will not be fixed by keeping solar radiation out of the atmosphere. Also humans. There's actually been a lot of interesting work lately looking at the impact of carbon dioxide directly on people, especially indoors where it tends to build up if there's not enough ventilation. So it's kind of ironic that as we need most to be smart and clear-headed, our ability to solve the problem could be negatively impacted by carbon dioxide. So that's just one example of geoengineering, but you can see it's fraught with, you can kind of tell where I am on this issue. It's fraught with problems because someday we would lose the resources or political will or interest in continuing that. And all of a sudden, you know, you have to keep putting these aerosols in the stratosphere. And the minute you stop, that's over. We've got three times the CO2 in the atmosphere at that point. Things are going to change really quickly at that point.
Or since we're on this topic, can you talk a little bit about carbon capture? Because that's also a hot topic that some people are banking on, I think, in the future to save our lives.
You know, that's a very, to me, that sounds like a very innocent, nice way to address this problem. If, you know, the root of the problem is the emitting of carbon dioxide, nobody wants to just not have energy, right? We would like to keep making energy somehow, whether that's renewables or traditional fossil fuels. We need energy. If we could stop the carbon dioxide from going into the atmosphere in the first place, I think that would be wonderful. That would do wonders for preventing the worst impacts of climate change. The CO2 is the biggest contributor to it. If we can stop it from getting in the atmosphere in the first place, that would be a huge win.
Dr. Karnauskas, you are a professor here at CU, and we had the privilege of hearing, I think, two talks from you now in the course of our master's studies. No, it's always a privilege. Are we doing enough to train the next generation of scientists and professionals to tackle climate change? And if not, what else do we need to do?
you know, I was thinking before talking with you guys that I think what you're doing is actually really the type of thing that we need more of. We need more visibility of this issue outside of it coming from just the climate change scientists. Everyone is used to hearing this drumbeat from people like me, who's, you know, a climate scientist, and who do you trust more than your doctor, right? And if you guys are going to be the future doctors, and I think these other communities like the medical profession, health sciences, really bringing some more visibility to this issue, I think would go a long ways.
So we hear a lot of myths, misconceptions, spinning of climate change because it is a politicized issue. What are some of those common myths that you've heard, and what would you say to the lay listener who encounters them?
You know, I think I'm sometimes I'm frustrated when I hear or see survey data that indicate that people think that scientists don't agree on this issue. And we've worked really hard for a long time to do our job objectively, run experiments, gather data, analyze them, and we agree. The scientific community, something like 99%. There's been actually a lot of papers written about this sort of meta studies that try to quantify how many scientists and how many, you know, legitimate climate scientists actually agree on this, and it's so overwhelmingly in agreement. I think that's one of the most important myths that I would love to see debunked is the myth that climate scientists actually don't agree on the cause of the problem, how much of a problem it is. We really do. We're scientists, so we look for ways to improve that information and to make the error bars smaller. But just because there's uncertainty and just because there's error bars doesn't mean we're not sure that this is a problem. We're doing our job and trying to, you know, reduce the uncertainties. You know, it's also not really a fair fight either. We're scientists, and we're not, compared to lobbyists and hired guns from industry. You know, it's not a fair fight. They are really good at what they do when it comes to public perception and information and lobbying. And, you know, that is not how we're trained when we get our PhD. So we're doing our science. There may be 99% of us climate scientists or legitimate scientists who think that climate change is happening, but all it takes is one very powerful, strong, well-paid voice to go out there and make it look like it's a 50-50 debate going on. It's just not a fair fight in terms of the resources that and time that scientists have to devote to, ensuring accurate public perception of the state of the science.
An unfair fight, and one with huge consequences.
Yes.
Yeah. Dr. Konauskas, thank you so much for being here with us today. Is there anything else you'd like to add for our listeners?
No, it's been my pleasure. Thanks, guys, for coming here.
Thank you.
All right. For our listeners, that is it for this episode of Attention Humans. Please check out the website for our show notes. Otherwise, we hope you'll tune in next time. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Attention Humans, the podcast of the University of Colorado Consortium for Climate Change and Health.
We unpack the human health dimensions of climate change and emphasize the urgent need for all of us to get involved.
We want to thank Dr. Rosemary Rochford and Dr. C.C. Sorensen for their mentorship on this project.
Ellen McFarlane and Matt Cook for technical support.
Cake for the jam and theme music.
Our awesome guests for sharing their expertise.
And you, our listeners, for paying attention.
See you next time.